everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood, and welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as always, by all of you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
We are talking about the art and, I suppose, in some ways, the science of propaganda, the power of social influence, and what and whom you ought to be paying attention to.
And I know you're thinking, don't you always talk about that? Which is true, but in Make Me Smart fashion, we're going to dig into it a little more today. We're going to talk about, among other things, Facebook, just who has been buying ads there and how much influence they might have.
Also, we will be getting a whole bunch smarter, and I promise you this is true because this is a great interview, with April Reign, that's R-E-I-G-N. She has this thing where she can use social media to address the entertainment industry's blind spots, specifically Oscar So White and also No Confederate. And if you don't know what that means, we'll explain it to you coming up.
Yes. Or if you're near your computer, you could just, you know, DuckDuckGo it real quick and get caught up. Right before we get there, let's jump right in with a propaganda version of our fix.
So did you say DuckDuckGo on purpose, or was that like a I don't want to say a Google thing? Oh, that's interesting.
I'm trying not to say Google because everybody should use DuckDuckGo because it does not, this is not an ad, it does not track your search history or store it, which nobody needs to be doing.
But if we get lucky, maybe they'll buy ads here soon. Anyway, this this episode is all about influence. It's about people trying to get other people to believe certain things or actually not believe certain things. It's advertising in a way, I suppose you could think of it, which lets me throw this statistic in there. Global ad sales, $579 billion. Takes a lot of forms, too.
Interesting. Yeah, the ad part of that, as you're going to see, is more and more interesting. Let's start with the definition of propaganda, because I love this stuff. And you know that at some point, the Merriam-Webster the Twitter feed has probably shade-tweeted this definition. Let's see. The definition of propaganda, the spreading of ideas, information, or rumor for the purpose of helping or injuring an institution, a cause, or a person. Ideas, facts, or allegations spread deliberately to further one's cause or to damage an opposing cause. Also, a public action having such an effect. And then there's some trivia. If you capitalize it, it's a congregation of the Roman Curia having jurisdiction over missionary territories and related institutions. I heart you, dictionary.
Learn something new on this podcast every single day. Obviously, we're talking about this because, and this is completely coincidental, Hillary Clinton's book came out today, which gets us to the election and all that jazz. We're not talking about it because of Hillary Clinton's book, but it, as it happens, did. There's so much going on about this now. It's the Russians in the election. It's Reddit and hate speech. It's Charlottesville. It's all kinds of stuff that's happening out there in a lot of ways, almost, I'm just going to say this, Molly, and see what you think, almost without us knowing about it.
I think that that is the fascinating part. And it's not, it has now gotten to the point, and I think in some of the response to Hillary Clinton's book and book tour, you can see that some of it is a is an actual unwillingness to look at it and to take it seriously because it sounds kind of conspiracist to say, look, our election was whole cloth influenced by a Russian propaganda effort. Although it is increasingly clear that that was absolutely the case and that we are essentially in an, as Slate put it, an information war with Russia, and it's time we started acting like it. We're here to reduce the hysteria down to the facts because propaganda, information warfare, the use of social media for influence, the use of strategic ad buying for influence, those are all phrases and concepts that we understand perfectly and feel, frankly, quite comfortable with. And it is a very short hop. I was just describing the Tesseract thing to my son last night because he's starting to read
The what now thing?
He's reading A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle, the graphic novel.
Yes.
Turns out they have a graphic novel, so if your kid's put off by the physics. But how the Tesseract is sort of like if two ants were walking along a really long string, but you folded the string in half, then the ant could just make a little short hop. So it's just a short little hop to Russia did this. And they're really good at it. And they're not the only ones, right? Alt-right groups, white nationalist groups are using social media in the same way. There is just, as of, I think, yesterday, a new fresh paper in which researchers from the Georgia Institute of Technology, among others, examined whether Reddit banning hate speech in 2015 had an impact. And they found that it did. It had a significant impact in reducing the amount of hate speech that was flying around Reddit. to what effect on society, we don't know.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to throw in your First Amendment slippery slope.
Well, yes, I know.
You're the one. I don't know.
I know.
If you remember many moons ago.
Well, so.
Right?
This is an argument. I know, exactly. Yeah. And I'm not going to argue against myself because this is an argument that we have been having on this show for a long time. Yep. And that's part of what makes this conversation so interesting. I would argue, well, there's that wonderful Matthew Ingram, the oatmeal comic that says, you know, free speech doesn't mean that anybody has to listen to your BS.
Right.
And it also doesn't mean that Facebook, for example, or Twitter don't have to take some responsibility, or Reddit, for what happens on their platforms. They can err towards speech, but if they, if in the case of Facebook, where it was recently reported that there were at least $100,000 worth of ads taken out specifically to promote fake news, and Facebook knew those ads were being sold and has lots of mechanisms in place to prevent different kinds of content from appearing, but did not stop them from being purchased. And then when it reported them, didn't tell people what the content was, didn't tell us how many people saw them, didn't tell us what pages were associated with the ads, didn't talk about what specific targeting criteria the Russian ads chose, then that's a protection of society issue that runs right up into the free speech issue. And I don't have an answer except awareness.
Right. There is no answer. So let's lay this out there just so we get factual grounding here, right? 17 American intelligence agencies have said with, quote, high confidence, which is the intelligence community word for we believe this happened factually, high confidence the Russians interfered and attempted to interfere with our election, right? So there's that. There is the Facebook $100,000 that they took in ads over the course of the campaign. My question for you is, should Congress subpoena like Zuckerberg and Steve Huffman, the CEO of Reddit, and maybe Jack Dorsey from Twitter, and get them up in front of that long green table in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee and ask them what the what?
Yeah, I think that they should subpoena Zuckerberg.
But not the other two guys?
In the cases of Reddit and Twitter, yes, like Twitter allows you to create great bot armies, and that happens on Reddit and that happens on Twitter. That to me is not as concerning as this is part of our business model, which is what's happening at Facebook. This is part of our business model.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay.
And, you know, I mean, they're selling and Senator, there are already some senators saying that the $100,000 and the Russian Facebook ads was probably just the tip of the iceberg. You know, almost certainly. The tip of the iceberg. And Facebook makes no secret to advertisers of its influence and power and reach. And so if that is the case, then I think it could be said, it could be argued, and this is sort of the flip side of the free speech thing, it could be argued that Facebook's business model is borderline national security issue.
Wow, that's a whole nother ball of wax, right? Because, I mean, you and I have had the conversation on should they be regulated as a public utility, right? Because we all agree that the American electrical grid, or the grids, since there isn't just one, is in fact a national security issue. And it is focused on at the highest levels of the Department of Homeland Security. It's very interesting to bring up this point of whether Facebook's business model is an issue for national security, because that would just be, holy cow, that'd be, I don't even know what to say. That'd be freaking fascinating.
Only because they're so non-transparent.
Yep.
I think that's the part where it really, that's the part where, you know, and The Intercept made this argument yesterday, Sam Biddle made this argument that Mark Zuckerberg should testify and that he should be called under oath to say exactly what the impact is, to say this is how the algorithm works, this is how many people were potentially targeted, so that we know how serious this is, you know, so that we can quantify that.
I don't want to get all partisan here, but I have to believe that even the defense and national security hawks in the Congress, like Lindsey Graham, like John McCain, I wonder what they would say about the government reaching into the guts of an American corporation, which is not regulated as a utility, and saying, give us your competitive secrets.
Yeah.
Wow. And what do you do if you're a shareholder, right? I mean, if you're a shareholder and Zuckerberg gets that subpoena, do you sell or do you buy? Right?
You know. That's a really good question. I don't know. Is it a matter of, is this like Apple being asked to crack the iPhone? I mean, is it a matter of truly turning over all of the secrets? It's not like Facebook necessarily has to lay out the algorithm. Zuckerberg could just show up with the data. This is how many people were reached. This is how many ads were purchased. This is the, these are the pages where it appeared. Some of these are really simple.
That's not controversial, right? That's, yeah.
Well, apparently it is, because this is information Facebook will not release.
Yeah, because they don't have to yet.
And this company is notoriously, I mean, they don't say anything. Even ex-Facebook people don't say anything. Like, Facebook doesn't say anything. And I guess the question we're getting at and the thing we're circling around is whether social media is a tool that's unprecedented in our society.
Well, it is.
You know, and whether the reach of Facebook is something that is unprecedented enough to warrant measures that are that extreme. I'm sure that there have been companies throughout history before that had this kind of scrutiny because of their power, right? Railroads or... Yes,
but none that reached 2 out of every 7 people on the planet.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
You know, they've got 2 billion users.
The stakes are really high. And this is, it's, you know, unlike newspapers and TV broadcasts of the past where people like you and I did the, and our editors did the agenda setting.
Yeah.
Social media and Facebook's influence is totally uncontrolled. It can be manipulated. Yeah. It can be bought. We don't know how it works. It's a totally black box.
Da, tovarish. Sorry, just kidding. It's about all the Russian I know. So let us know what you think about all this stuff, because honestly, it's fascinating and we could have gone on forever, but we can't because, you know, things to do. Make me smart at marketplace.org or go to the website, makemesmart.org. Find us on Twitter at Kai Rusdahl and Molly Wood. And also you can probably find us on Facebook too if you wanted to.
Ugh, I know the inescapable part, because I really this week have been like, I'm shutting it down. I'm getting off. However, at least for this moment, and we're working on it, is where Facebook is where we hold our weekly editorial meetings. And that is where we hear from you about the things that you want us to cover on the show, like fake Americans on Facebook. And those happen on Mondays at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern on our Facebook pages. We are in the process of testing streaming to multiple locations at once, however. So soon you can watch us on that scrappy little upstart that has no terrifying influence over America at all, YouTube. LOL. Sob.
April Rain coming up. It seems fairly ominous, this music. I'm not sure how I'm feeling about the producer choice here.
I love it. I get it.
Makes me want to get on a horse and ride with a sword someplace.
I would like to. Yes. I have a fun fact. It may not seem related to what we just talked about, but it is. The Emmy Awards are this coming weekend, September 17th. Wow. And this year's Game of Thrones has no nominations.
Seriously?
None.
What is that?
Was it snubbed? Do you know why?
I don't know why. Otherwise, I would have said, oh, I know why.
No, it's because they whiffed it. The eligibility period for the Emmys, because they were crafting every single thing like a handmade silver cup.
Know.
The eligibility period for the Emmys goes from June 1st to May 30th of the next year, and Game of Thrones premiered in July.
How long are we going to have to wait for the final season, by the way? Do you know?
I'm not waiting. Are you kidding me? It's like 2 years from now. I'm moving on.
All right.
I've cut that off like a piece of grayscale.
We nicely done. Nicely
Thank you.
Done. We, I'm going to start calling you Maester from now on. We told you that so we could tell you this. April Rain knows a little something about award shows and timing thereof and all this jazz. She was a lawyer for 20 years until basically she decided she didn't want to be a lawyer anymore, wasn't really satisfied by it, and took to Twitter and discovered that she has, and you can only call it like a knack, for influencing corporations and organizations to make changes that they might not otherwise want to make. And the story goes like this. One morning back in 2015, she turned on the TV, and here she is, April Rain.
So I was in my family room one January morning watching the Oscar nominees be announced on a morning television show, as I did every year. Huge movie fan, regular moviegoer. And Chris Hemsworth, who plays Thor in the Marvel Avengers series, was doing the presenting that year. So I was in my family room half dressed because I needed Thor in HD, in a suit, on the biggest TV that I could find that I had in my house.
I think we all do.
So I was getting dressed. Mm-hmm. Right. It was a beautiful morning. So I was getting dressed downstairs, and it just struck me, and I'm not sure why on this particular day, because obviously this is an ongoing issue, but it struck me that morning that every single category, both in front of and behind the camera, so the actors and the actresses, but also the documentaries and the directors and the cinematographers, they were all coming from what seemed to be an incredibly homogenous group. So I picked up my phone and went to, again, you know, Twitter, because that's where my tribe is. And I tweeted one time, "Oscar so white, they asked to touch my hair." Mm-hmm. And that was it. And then I finished getting ready for work and checked in around lunchtime. And the hashtag was trending internationally.
God, that's crazy. Wow. Right? I mean, that's crazy.
It is a little crazy.
Yeah. I mean, you have a lot of Twitter followers. You know, you have 104,000 Twitter followers, which is a very substantial amount. And yet you somehow have this gift, I would say. I mean, there are entire industries, there are entire jobs around trying to engineer the type of virality that you have accomplished over and over and are now doing with the No Confederate hashtag. What do you think it is? You know, what is everybody else missing?
Me.
Yes.
I think there's something to be said for my ability to sort of galvanize a movement, I think, at this point. At that time, my follower count was around 8,000. So it's obviously grown exponentially. But I bring that number up because I think it's important for people to understand that you don't have to have, you know, six figures worth of followers or something like that to make a difference. Oscar So White happened very organically. We'll get into No Confederate in a minute. And that one was much more targeted and focused. But for Oscar So White, I really think that, you know, if we talk about branding and that kind of thing, you have to be incredibly intelligent about making sure that your hashtag is short and sweet, right? Because you only have 140 characters. Mm-hmm. You also have to be incredibly consistent. So once I realized that this thing was going to take off, you know, you have to decide if you are going to be the face of whatever it is, the campaign or a movement or a cause or what have you. And then you have to stick with it if that's the choice that you make. You also have to be, I think, incredibly authentic. People know that they're getting the real unvarnished me.
Hmm. So Twitter is obviously this amazingly powerful thing for you, and you are making it work. But there's a flip side to Twitter, which is that it's a disgusting, vile cesspool of the worst of humanity.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
Well, you're right. how do you thread that needle?
Yeah.
You know?
I like to think that I do it with style and grace. I think, you know, it can be difficult at times. Mm-hmm. And so those of us who have visible or hyper-visible platforms, especially those of us who are women of color, receive the brunt of it. Every day I wake up to something negative in my mentions, and you just know that that's part of, that comes with the job.
Is it ever scary, though? I mean, do you ever feel like there's, I don't know, do you ever feel overwhelmed by being the face of these campaigns and the how easily someone can reach you with that negativity? Or as Kai would put it, vileness sometimes?
Right. It can be scary. You know, I have two children, and so I attempt to shield them and the rest of my family from my online persona, I guess, for lack of a better term. And so it can get scary from time to time. You know, at this point, I have a wonderful community on Twitter. And so when people see that there's a significant amount of negativity coming at me, you know, they will jump in on my behalf. And it makes it feel a little bit safer for me. The ironic thing for me is because my tribe is on Twitter, even if I'm feeling upset or overwhelmed or what have you, the place that I want to go to talk to folks about how I'm feeling is Twitter. So, you know, there's definitely a back and forth there for me.
All right. So let's talk about the impact of Oscar So White, the little hashtag that could, because after the 2016 Oscars, you know, this was not a new complaint, but this hashtag somehow had the propaganda effect. It catapulted the conversation into the mainstream. The Academy retired, quote unquote, retired a bunch of its older voters. These were people who were no longer working in the industry. They are actively working, they say, on diversifying their membership. And then in 2017, 7 of the 20 acting nominations were for people of color. And then, of course, in the most dramatic reveal ever, Moonlight, the tiny film with an all-black cast, won Best Picture.
Yeah, which was super cool, including kind of the way it happened and that dude pulling the card out. But anyway, there is another hashtag that she's known for. She alluded to it. In fact, she said it. No Confederate. It's all about the show that the guys who created Game of Thrones actually were going to make after Game of Thrones is done, called Confederate. The press release said, alternate timeline, southern states have successfully seceded from the Union. And here's the operative phrase, in which slavery remains legal and has evolved into a modern institution. That, for reasons that one would hope are apparent, did not go over well, including with one April Rain. Here she is again.
HBO announced that they are going to do a what I would call a slavery fan fiction show based on the premise that the Confederacy won after the third Civil War in this country. And so Black people were once again enslaved in the South. And it just seemed like a really bad idea, you know? So, yeah, and obviously this was announced before the horrible events in Charlottesville. And so someone reached out to me, Chanel Little reached out to me and three other Black women on Twitter and said, hey, what do you think about us doing something organized about this? And so the five of us talked, created the No Confederate hashtag, and decided what we were going to do. The goal of the campaign at that point was to have the No Confederate hashtag trend on Twitter during Game of Thrones, and specifically during that time, 9 p.m. on Sunday evenings, because the creators and the producers of this new Confederate show are creators and producers of Game of Thrones. Right. So we wanted to happen during that time. Mm-hmm. We had about 3 days to mobilize, you know, people. And literally we had people tweeting No Confederate from around the world, you know, Singapore and Japan and Brazil. We had people telling us, I created a Twitter account specifically so that I could register my objection to this show. Hmm. So Sunday came around 3 days later. And in fact, not only was No Confederate trending nationally number one, but it was also number two in the entire world for the hour that Game of Thrones was on. So we were very proud of that, and there will be more to come.
Have you heard anything from HBO or the showrunners?
We haven't heard anything directly. We would still love to have that conversation, because even after Charlottesville, even after Heather Heyer was killed, HBO once again said that they're going to be moving forward with this show. And we think that that's incredibly tone deaf and insensitive based on, you know, the hateful rhetoric and the violence that we see in this country. You cannot call it an alternate history show when we are living out that history in present day.
April Rain right there talking about the No Confederate hashtag. I, for one, I'll just timestamp this right now. That Confederate show is going nowhere. Nowhere.
I was surprised they doubled down on it.
Yeah, it's still going nowhere. But really what it's about is that power of persuasion, right? And you can do stuff on social media. The Ruskies can, and, you know, everybody can, and April Rain can. And it works. And it's really, really interesting.
Well, and look, I've been obviously pretty down on Twitter on its usage and its impact on my mood and its efficacy. Because what I often feel is, like, do I really need to be the last tech columnist in the world to tweet about this issue? Is that really going to be the thing that puts somebody over the edge and makes them change their mind? No. This discourse is crap. And what that conversation with April Rain made me realize is that maybe it's not always. And maybe there is, you know, there is an equal and opposite reaction to that, too. I also want to point out a quick news thing that happened as we were talking, Senator Mark Warner, who, by the way, is the senator who said that the Facebook ads were the tip of the iceberg, is now specifically calling for the Senate committee investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election are discussing whether they think they need representatives from Facebook and Twitter to testify about misinformation spread on their websites.
We say it on this podcast and Congress acts. I'm just saying.
It's like inception.
Look, I'm just saying.
All right. April Rain also answered our Make Me Smart question, and we have more reaction from you, dear listeners, and that is all coming up in just a moment. All right, so we asked April the question, what is something you thought you knew that it later turned out you were wrong about? Not only did she have a great answer, but the answer led us to even more questions.
Something that I thought I knew was the importance of intersectionality with the LGBTQIA community and other marginalized communities. And I learned and was educated about it from Twitter. You know, so I am constantly, you know, even at my advanced age, I am constantly learning and growing, but I have learned so much more about intersectionality generally and specifically the LGBTQIA community. And so I was wrong in thinking, that I got it, that I understood, that I had a certain level of knowledge. And what I now know is that there's so much more that I need to learn.
Can I ask a really dumb question? Because I often wonder, sure. And since you, we can just indulge in the things we don't know. What is intersectionality? What do you mean when you say that?
Sure. I'm actually writing a piece about this right now. Intersectionality.
Oh, I'm so glad.
to me.
Make me smart, means, April.
Well, I'm trying. Intersectionality for me means that you acknowledge the different facets of my existence. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the piece I'm writing about right now is about feminism. And what I say is that although I believe that all women should have equity, I do not consider myself a feminist using that term because feminism for me has never been intersectional, which means, yes, you address the issues that I have as a woman, but you do not address the specific issues that I have as a Black woman. To be intersectional, you want to at least attempt to address all of those different facets that make a person whole. Hmm. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you.
Thanks so much, April. So LGBTQIA, by the way, the IA stands for intersex and asexual. I had to look it up. So, you know, now you know.
Thank you. All right,
straight
next.
Ahead, update from Texas. Is that what you were going to say? Were you going to say
yes,
update from Texas?
I totally
right, well, that's
was.
What I was going to say, too. So we're going to do that.
We're so smart.
Holy cow, a lot of hurricanes and tropical storms and all of that stuff. Lots of damage, loss of life, all of that stuff. And we talked a little bit about it, I guess last week, 2 weeks ago? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we did.
And we talked about how people were really coming together, and we talked about how long that feeling of community might last. And we got a really beautiful message about this from one of our listeners about what is happening now after Hurricane Harvey. Here's Gary from Dallas, Texas.
Molly and Kai, last week, Kai worried that with Congress coming back in session, the communal spirit experienced after Harvey was just going to go to hell. Molly announced that she wants to believe, and I'm with her. I drove down to Houston with a friend last week. We packed our trucks with shovels, wheelbarrows, gloves, masks, tools, and spent a week mucking out flooded houses, and the devastation just takes your breath away. It looks like the houses in these neighborhoods threw up on the curb with those families' possessions in a pile at the street. I worked side by side with locals from the churches, friends of the families, employees of BP, Texas Baptist Men, owners of Community Brewery in Dallas, teachers from the local schools, Cajuns from Louisiana, Tennesseans, and even Canadians on vacation from Alberta. They were all ages and all just wanted to help, working well into the night each day to try to stay in front of the mold that was forming in those houses. An SUV pulled up in front of the house we were gutting. Two women got out and announced, "We're from Waller, we didn't flood, and we just want to serve y'all dinner." Hmm. These women drove 35 miles to give us dinner. The homeowner was so choked up, he gave him a big hug right there in the street. I was in the street by my truck washing tile dust out of my eyes with a water bottle. A slow-moving car rolled up, and a 10-year-old rolled down the window, announcing to me, "You look like you need a cookie." She handed me a homemade chocolate chip. It was good.
Aww.
Molly, I also discovered my well of optimism. There'll be work down there for years to come, and I'll be going back. So, Kai, I'll leave you with this. There is communal spirit out there, and it's strong. So seek it out, and it'll make your heart warm. This is Gary in Dallas, Texas.
I got nothing to add.
I am not going to cry, except I totally am. That's it for today, everybody.
Yeah, we're done. Make Me Smart, produced by Jenny Josephson, Emily Henderson, and Nance Fargali, who is, I am contractually obliged to say, the senior producer of this podcast. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is Sitara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. And Gary ruined my makeup.
Oh, now you have to go do TV, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Gary, bless. That was amazing. I did, though, throw my arms up in the air. Just at that point.
No, it's not yet. It's right. It's right. Wait. Hold on. Not yet. Yeah. There. Right there.
That's like a little happy finger dance. It's different.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.